Dan Graham, you have two pieces here, I think, in Documento.
This piece relates two showcase windows showing different goods in an arcade situation. I wanted to use actual urban architecture relating glass office buildings or showcase windows. It was relating Renaissance picture transparency and mirror perspective to video. In other words, in video, you have the ability to put the camera somewhere else so that you see yourself maybe from overhead, or maybe an image comes from the moon to a monitor where you are. So time and space can be changed, whereas in the mirror perspective, you're fixated in one area, looking at yourself fixated instantaneously in time. With time delay video, you can see yourself time delayed and other people time delayed. So you see your behavior, it influences you, and then you're seeing yourself again. It's kind of a brain time.
What actually happens, of course, is that you actually suddenly see yourself in the showcase window. I hadn't seen this piece before, and I found it really very disconcerting because it took me seconds to realize that I was actually looking at myself, and then to realize that I was actually looking at myself in time past. And it only happened when I actually called somebody back to say, look, you've missed the Dan Graham piece. And I didn't quite know at that point what the Dan Graham piece was, except that it was apparently a video in a window. And as I said it, I realized seconds later that the person I was looking at was myself.
Well, there are two windows, and there's goods in the two showcase windows and mirrors, TV camera, and TV monitor. What you see in one one monitor is from the camera on the other side, which is either looking straight at the window at you looking, or looking at the mirror, which shows you and also the time delay that other people are seeing with you on the other side. And it takes about 10 seconds, which is how long it takes to walk back and forth.
That piece, of course, is related, isn't it, to the performance pieces, the mirror performance pieces, in that sense that you have this delayed observation of behavior and then the repetition of it.
Yeah, I'm interested in the just past influencing your present. To have a time which is a brain time and a body time introduced in. I mean, it was an attack on Renaissance perspective, but yet it also fits into the seductiveness of showcase windows. This is where I thought it might be a Marxist piece, which I don't think actually happens that well, in that you're looking at video as a seductive element along with the seductive images of the goods, but you see yourself being seduced on the mirror in video. So I wanted to use the video to be seductive, but also to break it.
Finally, Dan, talk about another piece you have here in the Frederick Jahnum, which is a large pavilion work. It's being used extensively, having just been up there today. Is it one that differs in any significant way from other pieces of a similar nature you've made?
Yeah, the first one was 1988, designed for showing videos, which gives different boosts for 6 different video monitors and a very relaxed place to sit down and watch them. That was two-way mirror and glass in a kind of a labyrinthian format, so that as you sit down, the way the two-way mirror works is the side that's illuminated, which is reflective, also will reflect yourself, but transparently you can look through and see other people looking, yourself looking at other people looking as they look, and the images of different videos that they and you are looking at, which is similar to the outdoor piece where you're looking at yourself looking inside and outside, but here everything is inside and outside and people are looking at the video, the spectator process of the video. This one was done using punched aluminum and two-way mirror. And looking through the punched aluminum is similar to the pixels of the TV screen. And it's also a kind of a peephole effect when you get very close, and more opaque when you go further back.
Do you have anything to say about the argument of the whole of Catherine David's show, that is an analytical assessment of certain critical attitudes and the moment, in terms of perhaps it's more important to withdraw, stand back, to evaluate than to be that confident about object making, for instance. I mean, it seems to mirror certain things that were taking place in the 70s in terms of preoccupations.
I think Catherine David is basically a very brilliant analytical mind who's always questioning herself. The problem is, shows like this have to be fixed at some point, so the artists have one idea that they can play against. And what I love about German shows is their kind of upper middle class, quasi-philosophical, quasi-didactic themes, and they fix in the popular media, and you can play off them. Negate it, partially agree, flip the terms around, but here all the terms are her terms, so they're like a kind of analytic philosophy, which is only about itself, thinking and thinking and thinking, and rejecting and rejecting and rejecting. And also it doesn't deal with a fundamental problem, it more points attention to it.
Do you think then, if I can just pick up briefly the sort of Marxist theme, that there's a sense perhaps in which we're back in the condition in which the philosophers are seeking to understand the world, but not perhaps in the situation where we should be, which is the point being, as Marx said, to change the world? Do you think that maybe what we're talking about with David is that we're back in the whole business of simply trying in some perhaps fantasiacal and nihilist way to understand things, or to understand that things have no meaning, and actually what is required is some sort of analysis of the whole corporate takeover, not only of art but of everything else?
No, I think that's been analyzed to death. The idea is how to make a kind of collaborational politics with it. And also the working methodology and sort of the traps that people get into. There's a lot of new things that are not corporate, and they're very playful and different. But I think in France, everything is either analytical or it's megalomaniac. So they like Rem Koolhaas because he's doing megalomaniac things about China, or has this very simplistic idea, I think, of the periphery. But of course, there's no periphery without the city center, and I think people are afraid of the city, dealing with the city center, because the city center is occupied by the corporation. So romantically, they move away. In other words, there should be a dialectic between all these things. So there's always an absolutism in French analytical thinking. It's always extreme in a very reductivist kind of way. But I think that what's wrong with the show is, as smart as it is, it's, like everything else, nostalgic. A lot of nostalgia for the 60s, some brilliant people from the 60s, like Lucia Clark, the hippie period of Preeny. And also there's some great things picked out from shows of the last couple of years, like Stan Douglas's piece, or the original Jeff Wall idea of putting things in showcase windows. Which is how he began. And I think Catherine David is very sharp in picking these things. So she's made good selections and bad selections, like every other, you know, like every other curator.
Would you say then that the documentary itself constitutes part of what you said earlier, that the analyzing of things to death, and that it's not really offering much in the way of a critique of the very things that have led to the problems that she's confronting?
No, I wouldn't say that. You said it, so I'll let you say it.
Joachim Köster.
Joachim, I've just looked at your work here in Documenta 10. Basically, it's a video projection within an enclosed space of a string instrument group and images of people behaving as though they're at a private view. They're standing around drinking wine and so on. But can you talk a little bit about this piece?
Yeah, it's a string quartet playing a concert by Shostakovich in front of an audience who stands on the stage. So there's a pit and a stage, and that's the title, Pit Music, which is a setup for the both for the concert and now here at Documenta. I'm very interested in the sliding between documenting and dramatizing, and that's also the reason for the title, because usually the pit music coming from the pit is played for actors, but in this case it's only the invited people. The gallery invited some people, around 30 people, and they're viewing a concert, and through the editing and the filming, there's this sliding between between sometimes it seems like the event is totally like a normal concert, and other times the movements of the audience almost seem to choreographed, and you get this sense of dramatization or fictionalizing of the whole thing.
The performers and the audience occupy the same space in your piece.
Yeah. So it's there's this tension between the original event and the original audience, and now a new audience in a new space. So there's all these opposites: the original event and the documentation, the original space and the new space, and between music and image, because that's a very important issue in the video. How the interrelation between music and image, and the time in the image and time in the music.
One tension in the work is that the audience become as important as the performers.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, for sure. In that respect, you can almost call it a portrait or of the audience with music. So it can be work in the portrait genre. It's also playing with the whole idea of performance, because usually in performance art, the performance is a work, but you always tend to see the documentation. But in my case, the performance wasn't the work, the documentation was the work.
So the work is what we're seeing here in Documenta.
Yeah, that's the actual work.
The media representation becomes primary.
Yeah. And with all these possibilities there are for documenting, the minute that you place a camera, you're already put a viewpoint, and you're already to some extent decided how this event is going to be interpreted, and that's also an issue in the piece.
The physical way in which you've presented this work is to in reality have a sort of a pit in the front of the area that one stands on. Where the screen is.
I wanted to emphasize this side of it. It's not cinema. The actual space that you're standing in is important as the projection or the interrelation between the projection and the space, which is very different from, for instance, cinema or television, because in that case, usually the space is pretty much unimportant. It's always the same, a dark room and a screen or a television in a room. So.
My name is Christine Hills.
Christine, I've just come away from the Hauptbahnhof into the tunnel leading back to Kassel, and you have a shop here selling second-hand items. Can you tell me about this project?
Yeah, this project is called Folks Boutique. It is a franchise shop of an original shop in Berlin that I've been running since September of 1996. Folks Boutique is a concept, but it's also a second-hand shop. Right now, it's primarily a second-hand shop. The shop in Kassel is a second one. It's hoping not to replace the one in Berlin, but to represent it. Throughout the Documenta, Fridays and Saturdays, I'll be opening the shop. The clothing has all been donated. It's kind of an alternative to a secondhand project, that there's really not a lot of capitalism playing a role. The clothing has been donated. It enables me to sell it very, very cheaply. And still there's a profit turned, and that's the payment for my organization. Folks Boutique tries to describe that an artwork that is made out of thinking on your feet and doing the best with what you've got. Everything here has been put together, but it's not new. I haven't made any of these objects. I put them together, and that's what I've made. And that, for me, is how one can define the word Volksboutique. And when someone is wearing a T-shirt, for example, that says Volksboutique on it, that is not necessarily advertising for a secondhand shop. In Germany, it can be advertising for a lot of things, and in general, it can be just a concept, or it can be a band name, it can be a shop.
Are you selective about what you actually sell in the shop? There are a lot of people coming in.
I mean, I only deal in secondhand clothing. There are a lot of objects and things in the shop that are obviously shop things, but it doesn't mean that I'm selling my pencils and my pens. The clothing that comes in, however, is all sold. I attempt to sell it. I'm not picking them out because they're cool. It's a pretty democratic system. A lot of the stuff is hanging, and it's very trendy. A lot of the stuff is ugly, and it's all hanging together, and I'm hoping that people will still take it.
You're here for the duration of Documenta.
I will be here for the entire 100 days, but only Fridays and Saturdays.
How would you describe this location?
Perfect. I'm underground. I'm in a shop space that was built around the time I was. That's fine. It's right across from the Kulturbahnhof, from the train station. As soon as you go underground, there it is, right across opposite Jeff Wall.
Die Freiheit ist kein redlicher intellektueller Rührwürde. Das Museum der Zukunft. Dieses Projekt führte uns zum Paradox des Klingelmark, letztendlich zu so etwas wie Landschaftsmalerei. Die Geschichte dieses Projekts, wobei der Begriff Projekt eigentlich übertrieben ist, brachte Überraschungen und Rätsel und eigenartige Verwandlungen hervor. Kunst tauchte plötzlich im Bild als Sprache auf oder als Text, und umgekehrt zeigte sich Text plötzlich als Kunst oder als Malerei.
Ja, wir sind uns allerdings der Gefahren autobiografischer Künstlererzählungen bewusst. Es besteht natürlich immer eine Versuchung darin, zum Vorteil der Geschichte gut aussehen zu wollen und suggestive Bilder und Typen einzubauen.
Ja, trotzdem wollen wir die Geschichte erzählen. Es ist die Geschichte über eine Arbeit aus der Zeit von 1988 bis 1989. Diese Arbeit hatte, was nicht weiter verwunderlich ist,
So, Michael Baldwin, I've just witnessed the Art and Language performance here in Documenta in Frederikianum. Perhaps it would be useful for people listening for you to describe exactly what happened, and then we can talk about its concerns.
Okay, so it was an actor performing, I suppose, as me. There is certainly a great distance between him and me, both in appearance and so forth. But it was an actor lip-syncing a pre-recorded text, which is the text of a lecture which was given by Mel and me in Vienna in 1995 in a conference called Art and Language an Luhmann. And the Jackson Pollock Bar group, who are engaged in what they call theory installation, have taken a few picturesque tokens from the studio and a few slides which were slides actually which were shown in the lecture, and have rendered themselves into Charles Harrison, me, Michael Baldwin, and Mel Ramsden. But they lip-synced it in order to create, if you like, what I think is an extraordinary dramatic effect, which is, one expression I suppose you could use is like super alienation or super Brechtian effect or something like that. And given the, if you like, the picturesque aspect of the remnants from the studio and so forth, this distance is rendered all the more strange. I think their idea is to go on and do other texts. So they're not, as it were, wedded to us in any sense at all. But we have other collaborations in mind, however.
I mean, the first section of it was the lecture, I guess, that was translated, that we heard simultaneously.
But it was a simultaneous translation, however. It was not the English text in its original form. It is a text which is translated simultaneously, as it comes, as it were. So it's not an edited and well-formed translation. It's someone killing themselves to do it.
Was it done simultaneously? Were they two tapes?
One of the things that first attracted us to it is when we saw them do a similar performance in Vienna. It was a performance based on, I think, a 1950s radio program with a lot of the abstract expressionists. And it was obviously from the 50s, and the final part of it was, are there any questions? And you were in this kind of reverie of the 1950s, and the fact that you then couldn't ask someone from the 1950s any questions, brought a curtain down and made it a kind of quotation mark, which illuminated not the program, not the speech that they've just given, but the outside of the speech that they've just given. It seemed to bring you up and wake you up.
So this is, in other words, a lecture is if you like, takes place in what you might call epistemically normal circumstances. People can ask questions. People are supposed to consider it in a fairly, if you like, a first order sort of way. This shifts that whole thing back quite a distance, and as Mel says, puts a kind of box around it in some way. It could be, there's a sense in which it displaces us utterly. And this experience is very eerie for us, I might say.
I found it very eerie, particularly the second bit, and the way in which occasionally the syncing of the tape and the speech, there was a gap or separation or a dislocation.
Oh, yeah, the strange thing about it is that if you see a video of it, it doesn't work on video. It looks like a bad recording.
And yet it uses relatively high technology. It uses the soundtracks and the infrared headphones. It uses high-tech media tools in order to produce an effect which is not in itself capable of being rendered adequately within the media, which is a funny inversion, which I think quite interesting and satisfying.
Yeah, but there was a strange, as I say, dislocation between the real, the pre-recorded, the dialogue, but it not being a dialogue, but it was in a strange sense. I mean, it was convincing but unconvincing.
Right. Yeah, that's true. It wasn't actually written as a dialogue. Yeah. It was spoken as a kind of dialogue.
The original form was, but that's also really mangled by this soundtrack. Also, your attention wanders because you're trying to actually connect, as you do with badly synchronized films and things like that, and they start to become interesting. It starts to become a detail in the performance.
One listened to and heard became interesting that was on the edge, like the pouring of the drink, the cigarette, everything took on a sense of significance that you try to unpack.
So the pretensions the text has, as it were, what we regard as epistemically normal pretensions which the text has, are vaporized in a certain sense by its dramatic effect. The fact is, however, also that the text discusses realism and the various conditions and considerations attached to realism, and yet the form in which it appears is one which is, one might say, is dramatic almost beyond one's ability to stand it. It's a very strange circumstance in which to discuss realism. That's baroque realism or something.
Like the parts that normally one doesn't like in a kind of recording, all the bits, all the noise that you don't like, become features that are actually just as interesting as the text. And they fight with each other.
You don't know what to edit out or what to exclude.
Well, I was going to say, or they're edited out, so you don't see them.
Right. But you don't know. Right.
There would be no good grounds for editing any of that, or shifting any of that detail. It's just detail.
Finally, I mean, when I came earlier today, this was a very quiet space with works positioned in the gallery, as it were. Now they're pushed up against the wall. There are a series of, I suppose, chairs are the nearest I can describe them as formal objects. How does that sort of duality work in terms of the 1 minute, a fairly formal gallery presentation, the next minute, a teeming performance space such as we're in now?
The way that the work is now set out actually resembles the way it sat in the studio before it came here. So there is, at least on one level, strangely enough, there is a naturalistic aspect to it. The other aspect to it is that we had some pleasure in the thought that this strange and very difficult to reconstruct conversation had the effect of displacing the work in this place.
Certain aspects of the documentary management didn't want the this performance to be in the same space as the as the work, and they wanted to be somewhere else, of course, because it would be easier to manage. But both Michael and I and the Jackson Pollock Bar thought it was extremely important that it be in the same place, so that there's a kind of relationship between speaking and showing and language and art.
I think it also reinforces to some degree the aspect that the work has the tables and chairs, as it were, have, which is the sense of being slightly en déshabillé, slightly not to be seen. They're suddenly put in a... They are in a disarray in one form when they're being exhibited, because, I mean, their proper form is in the sense to be on the wall. And when they're shoved in the corner like that, it's another kind of disarray, another way in which they're not really to be approached, and that paying attention to them is a strange sort of voyeurism. And reading them. All right, then there's the text being spoken. So there are many forms of they constitute a very strange form of background detail to that Baroque text, if that's what it is.
Tell us about the Jackson Pollock Bar.
Why don't you ask Christian Mathiasen?
Interviews are only given by our actors, so I will call for Martin. Martin.
The Jackson Pollock Bar installated texts from theory texts. From Phil Gaston, Ed Reinhardt, Niklas Luhmann, Heiner Müller. And in this performance, we played a text from Art and Language.
Christian is based in Freiburg am Breisgau. He also ran other institutions and run conferences and something. Martin is an extremely well-known and talented actor in Germany. I mean, these are not amateur actors, as you can no doubt ascertain from the performance. The Jackson Pollock Bar is a bar. He actually has a bar in Freiburg am Breisgau. A real bar.
But it's also it's possible to go in other places to installate this bar. We were in Wien in the Hermann Loos Bar, and we can do every place we can do this work.
Yeah, but I also think it's an idea which in some ways is still in need of a certain amount of theoretical elaboration. What was interesting and exciting for us is that it stands in need of it. Much of the work remains to be done, and I think that's rare enough these days. It's not dusted off and cut and dried in any sense. It's open and a kind of inquiry, but it's a kind of inquiry. We're not entirely sure, what actual materials, what are the details, what are the instrumentalities which constitute this inquiry, and that's quite a satisfying position to be in. It's not how one is supposed to approach things these days, and refreshing.
Es ist ein endloser Dialog oder eine endlose Konversation, die bisweilen eine bildhafte oder malerische Wendung nimmt.
Ja, wir müssen das vielleicht näher erklären.
Sascha Kredek, here we are sitting outside in a very nice cafe, corner of the street opposite the Frederikianum. So what is your impression so far of Documenta 10?
My impression of Documenta 10 is that there is a rather large split between the intentions of the person who's organised it and the actual experience. And I'll just explain. I think that Catherine David has been probably understandably fairly defensive in terms of her exhibition. She's tried to defend it. It's almost as if she'd been to a sort of lawyer and had her statement, which has been read out rather than off the cuff, sort of turned into an affidavit. She's felt very, very worried about the position of art now, the fact that it's not possible to make any grand statement at all in art, and that the experience of art is almost perhaps secondary to more complex movements and senses people have. And so she very, very strongly covered herself in terms of using this word globalization. She's very, very adamant that she shouldn't have, in a kind of moralistic sense, to put in all the art of the world, things like this. In the end, all she is producing and showing is something called an art exhibition. It is not going to change the world. It's not real. It doesn't have a function. It has a function only as art. My feeling, which of course is what matters, is actually how one experiences the thing itself as opposed to the anticipation or the talk. And my sense is, especially on the second day, I'm really enjoying it. Obviously the work is dry. We're not exactly given, a fantastic, any great moments of visual spectacular. There's no sensory deprivation. We're not cast into the dark and moved about. We're not dealing with overweening ideas of death and so on. It's very subtle. But, if one is prepared to just move from piece to piece, it is enjoyable. It is certainly not providing certain artistic aspect. Now, I know that a lot of people talk about this being the last Documenta, because obviously it's hardly possible, or it's seen as perhaps arrogant to presume that you can speak for all or provide an experience that is for all, and which is what the Documenta is based on. And so there is the sense that she anticipates that problem and is covering herself in every possible way.
Mel Gooding, who's sitting to my right, said a minute ago that an exhibition can be a sort of a thesis, and in a way this is a thesis, but it somehow doesn't reside within what we're looking at in terms of the manifestation. But on then, having said that, I think Catherine David is saying that part of this exhibition is to do with this 100 days of discourse and discussion. So it's almost impossible to get the thesis by coming and visiting it.
Well, yes, again, what she's done is say, listen, for God's sake, I'm not in any way just putting on something called an art exhibition. Heaven forbid, I'm showing architecture, I'm talking about war, life, not death so much, it's not so dramatic. I'm talking about everything that matters in this world, because art itself is somehow, for her, perhaps somewhat insignificant, the actual art experience. And so what you have is this thing called 100 Days, with 100 participating clever people. Now, I spoke to an artist just now who's showing work, I hope I pronounced his name right, the guy is showing work in the hall just before, at the entrance. It's the interview with somebody who's come back to Nigeria after visiting Europe. And I spoke to him a lot, and he's put that piece there, as all artists would say or imply, as a criticism of the idea of the 100 days, because actually very few artists are participating in the 100 days, because suddenly we've got very much more clever people, supposedly, i.e. the thinkers of this world, coming and talking. That is very, very interesting, perhaps, but it does not, in a way, change the fact that ultimately Documenta is the experience, is for people to experience art, a lot of it, and to set up some kind of thought process between the pieces. But given all this, and apparently my criticism, I have enjoyed myself tremendously. Once I've decided that I'm on a kind of line, I'm thinking I'm not exactly going to be moved, and I'm very glad she has actually played down the jokiness of life, the sort of over-dramatic aspects of art which have driven me completely mad, are lacking here. So in other words, we are here quietly going from piece to piece, and in some way it is thought-provoking.
So finally, will you go away with the memory of a particular piece of work?
I won't go away with the memory of a particular piece of work, because it's hard to, but what I will do is go away with the memory of one convergence of pieces. Upstairs there is, because perhaps the space is not sort of linear with long corridors, there's much more of an interaction spatially, a three-dimensional interaction of thought. And so the sisters who use sort of sewing, knitting and so on, and set up a so-called information exchange, a woman whose name I forget from Germany who does drawings which are kind of spacey, and then there's this kind of reference which is continuous these days in art to a notion of space, which is basically, if anybody looks into it, a kind of romantic look back to somewhere else, somewhere, i.e. the 50s, when everyone was in love with science fiction. So there is that kind of feeling all at once.
So, the sounds in this space are coming from a piece called Heart by Siobhan Hapaska.